Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the Netflix original film, His House, which is about a South Sudanese refugee couple who seek asylum in the UK and are released from detention and placed in this housing, low-income housing of some kind, and things kind of go downhill from there.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that more or less lays it out, so
you don't need a ton of background. Yeah, so we open with their harrowing ocean journey. What are their names, incidentally?
Ball and Rial, the man and the woman, respectively. Uh-huh.
So Ball is having a nightmare about their ocean crossing. Several of the people that they were traveling with drowned, including their daughter, perished at sea on choppy water. And they're wrestling with survivor guilt. It's a heavy movie. It's a gut punch in more ways than one. On the heels of this sort of trauma processing dream, which he then wakes up and tells his wife about, we get a scene where they get good news in the form of some suit who informs them that they're going to be released from the detention that they've been held in and given their own place. Citizenship has not been conferred upon them. They have a whole bunch of hoops they need to jump through still, and they need to toe this line very carefully. They're given a litany of things that they must do and things that they must not do in order to remain in contention for asylum. They can't leave, they can't have people over, they can't... Some of more of this is elucidated when someone who works for the agency, played by Matt Smith, is leading them around their new digs, which is pretty decrepit. And he's talking about how you can't have people over, you can't throw parties, you definitely cannot change addresses, which I thought was clever, because the question in movies like this is always, why don't they just leave the haunted house?
Well, you can't.
Yeah, here, yeah, they'd be jeopardizing.
You have to go back to a war zone.
Right. And then you'd have made all these sacrifices for nothing. So they are highly incentivized to remain in the haunted house. It's the cleverest solution to that problem that I've seen in some time. And it is a problem that's as old as the hills. That's why it's the first question on everybody's lips.
Yeah. So, as Matt said, this house is pretty decrepit and gross. Matt Smith says something about how, oh yeah, we haven't been able to have the cleaners come by. There's like a rotting pizza box and all manner of detritus on what little lawn they have out front. And it's just, it's wallpapers peeling and there's moldy looking spot. It's gross.
And it's not clear if this is trash left over from a previous tenant or just a squatter. It amounts to the same thing.
Or even just everybody else in the housing estate dumps garbage there just because.
Right.
Just because it's vacant.
You know? Right.
Any one of those explanations.
It is a larger than average pad for someone in their position.
They make a point of saying this multiple times.
As though that conferred any additional luxury on them, when in fact it's just more blight for them to deal with.
Like, give me a clean studio, please.
Right. Give me a clean broom closet.
Yeah.
So it's a fixer-upper, as I believe we've established. The guy starts fixing it up as best he can. There's a rather spooky sequence. Reminded me of the kind of scare that you would get in a Japanese or Korean horror film. He is mucking about trying to get into the insulation, I think, and then a spirit, a ghost of some kind, materializes behind him as he's on the floor. He gets up off the floor and you see a strange woman, cheek resting against the tiled floor, kind of just leering, hanging out behind him.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a woman. I thought it was a girl. I thought it was his daughter.
It was, yeah. It is his daughter.
Yeah, who's 6 or 8 or something like that. Relatively young, but yeah.
It's sort of a blink and you miss it thing. But yes, I believe that's correct.
And these encounters become steadily less and less blink and you miss it.
Right.
More like close your eyes for a minute and you open them up and they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
Much to your chagrin.
Yes.
And his.
You'll be sorely tempted to do so. He's a little slower on the uptake than his wife, although they both wise up pretty quickly. She has a paranormal encounter of her own where she has been grocery shopping and she drops, I think, a peach on the ground that comes to a stop and then starts rolling again of its own volition in defiance of Newtonian physics.
I don't even think she drops it. I think she's in the room with the hole in the wall, and a bunch of peaches fall from a bag in the kitchen, and one just rolls completely of its own accord all the way. All right,
so the supernatural shenanigans start even before I cared to admit.
Yeah.
And she hears a voice. She levels with her husband about this. The walls are talking to me. This place is haunted. She's very candid about it.
She tells this anecdote about a night witch. What is the word they use?
Apeth, I think.
Yeah. Tells this story about this guy who wants to better himself and wants to build himself a house in his village, and he doesn't have the wherewithal to do so, and he steals from this old man in the village without realizing that the old man is an Apeth who follows his possessions to the man's new house and haunts the new house. And so, even though Baal and Rial have not stolen goods or whatever, somehow they have a night witch haunting their new home.
Yes, they haven't incurred the wrath of a witch somehow, which actually also addresses the why don't they just leave the house problem, because presumably it would follow them.
It would follow them, yeah. It also answers the implicit question asked by the title, whose house? Probably the witch's house.
Right, yeah, exactly. That's why it's not, the movie's not called Their House. Because right. It does not belong to the couple.
It is also not Run's house.
Yes. And she says as much. She says, we don't belong here in this very scene.
Yeah, he's making repeated efforts throughout the middle portions of this movie to assimilate. He goes out and buys crappy, like, H&M or The Gap grade polo shirts and chinos and whatnot.
He makes a game effort of fitting in with some blokes at the pub who are singing this, like, asinine
footballer song.
Yeah, which his wife duly chides him for.
He makes a show of eating with a knife and fork while she's using the, I don't know what the bread is called, that is used kind of as an edible utensil in, you know, Sudan and much of North Africa. I've encountered it at, like, an Ethiopian restaurant, but presumably it's a similar sort of thing. But anyway, his wife is sticking to this method of eating with the bread and her hands.
And when they argue, she lapses into their native tongue, and he is none too pleased with that.
It's like English, and she says, I will speak my mother's language or something to that effect. So he's trying to assimilate, and she's not really having it, particularly once it's clear that there's something trying to drag them back, basically.
And to the movie's credit, I said that he was slower on the uptake than her, and that isn't even really true. They both acknowledge the problem, and they approach it differently.
Right.
He's a little bit more in denial about it, and also is just
refuses to knuckle under.
Right, yeah, he just thinks it can be resolved. He burns something of some heirloom of hers.
Well, basically, he burns anything that connects them back to the old country.
Right, you know, surely one of these objects is cursed.
Right, burns her necklace that I think they imply came from their daughter, burns her head covering, burns a variety of other possessions, just burns them out in the back patio.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I like that emerges from these arguments, of which they have more than one, she goes out of her way to say that she is not afraid of ghosts, per se, after all they've been through. Right. You know, she's seen some shit. She's got a thicker skin than that. She's not easily rattled. But she says, well, aren't you even the least bit curious what the walls have been saying to me? She's not scared that the walls are talking. She's scared of what they're saying, which is that, first of all, that she should be afraid of him, her husband, and secondly, that there's some kind of Faustian element here, that they could get their daughter back if they met the demon halfway somehow. It's not exactly clear what that compact is going to look like at first.
Yeah. He steadily has more and more harrowing encounters with the various ghosts.
Yeah, it seems to be singling him out. There's one kind of do or die one where he is attacked in his kitchen by multiple spirits, and they nearly get the better of him. His throat's about to be slit. It's a scene that sets up the classic light switch gag, that you're safe in the light but not in the darkness, and so he's straining to reach the light switch as he's being dogpiled by all these ghouls.
Ghouls.
Ghouls. And that's probably his closest brush with death. A lot of the encounters are framed as nightmares. He has one very striking one. He is it segues smoothly from one of their dinner arguments, and all of a sudden he is very pointedly scraping a fork and knife across his plate. You know, this deafening clink clink sound, and the camera pulls out and he's at sea.
Yes, he's got like a fragment of wall to his left
just to obscure the reveal more than anything of the waves,
but even that has holes in it. And he's got his kitchen table that he's sitting at, and then an empty chair across from him, and yeah, it's just water everywhere, and it's like he's in a fragment of his kitchen floating across the River Styx.
Right, yeah, it's a very arresting image, really. A just fantastically eerie sequence, just the anti-ASMR noise of the scraping silverware just gets my teeth on edge. And then when the camera pulls out, you feel kind of the enormity of the ocean bearing down on you, which is how someone in his position would feel, I imagine, subjectively. Like, you made it, but it's still with you. That trauma doesn't really go away. It kind of dwarfs this little domesticity that you've created for yourself. It's peeking through the holes.
Yeah.
So the movie goes on like this for some time. I believe it's after his encounter in the kitchen where he nearly gets his head cut off that he goes in to lodge a formal complaint
with Matt Smith.
With Matt Smith. He starts out playing it cool. There are rats. There are vermin, roaches. The house is making us sick. My wife is ill. She went to a doctor. The doctor said, you've got to change houses. To which one of Matt Smith's coworkers says, oi!
His place is bigger.
It's bigger than me house.
That's not on.
You get the idea.
Punch you right in the gabber, innit? Swear on me, mum. It's not quite that absurd.
So Matt Smith is the most sympathetic of the men in the room, but he's still kind of not having it.
He goes to great lengths to be like, some people, not me. But some people would say, basically, you're being ungrateful.
Right.
Again, this is in keeping with, it's bigger than my house.
Right.
Who the hell do they think they are?
Yeah.
And Ball gets steadily more on edge. He's like having a nervous breakdown in this office.
Which is disastrous, potentially, because if you're not supposed to step out of line even a little bit, much less have a public meltdown.
Yeah, he was brought a glass of juice at Matt Smith's urging, and he has drunk some of the juice, and he's got the glass in his hand.
Out of frame, crucially. I think it's obscured by the desk.
By the desk, yeah. And we just hear this crunching noise while he has this sort of like crazed smile on his face. And when I say crazed smile, you might think like, oh, eyes wide, but it's like, no. The rest of his face looks basically normal.
A little pained, if anything. Like he's like grimacing except for his mouth, which is grinning, and that disconnect is disturbing.
Yes. And we hear this crunching noise, and Matt and I think, had both forgotten that there was a glass involved. So yeah. Like, what is that noise? Good Lord.
It's more like anti-ASMR silverware scraping. It's like, I don't know where it's coming from. I just want it to stop.
And eventually we discover, oh, he has smashed the glass in his hands, and Matt Smith is duly discomfited.
Mm-hmm.
Ball just sort of
makes a hasty getaway.
Yeah, abruptly sprints out of there.
This is followed up by a scene where Matt Smith and one of his cohorts comes to pay them a house call and finds that the wall is now riddled with holes. Basically, it looks more blighted than when they moved in.
Yeah, because in the aftermath of one of Ball's repeated ghost encounters, first he peels the wallpaper one night, and then another night he takes a hammer to the drywall or whatever the walls are made out of, shouting like, this is my house, get out, to the ghosts. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, now that at least the living room, the family room, whatever you want to call it, the den, is a complete war zone.
And this is bad enough on the face of it. And then his wife exacerbates things by coming into the room and very blithely telling the two white men who have their fate in their hands, oh, he didn't tell you about the ghost?
The witch.
The witch, yes.
Yeah, there's a witch here.
Mm-hmm. A great beast, I think she calls it as well.
Yeah.
And she's doing it not because she's checked out or just foolish. She's trying to sabotage their stay.
Yeah.
I mean, she wants to be sent back.
This has been her line for some time. Not only does she not want to assimilate, she thinks they have to go back because they have to pay a debt that they owe on account of their daughter's death.
Mm-hmm.
Rial has some flashbacks to South Sudan, some scenes where she's like spending time with other women in like a schoolhouse sort of situation. There's another one, I mean, they all kind of run together, but there's another one where she's like hiding in some kind of cupboard and hears her husband calling for her, gets out, and he comes into the room and like gets her up off the floor. And finally, the camera turns and widens out, and we see the rest of the room. It's just filled with corpses.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, she was hiding out from some kind of death squad.
Yeah, she narrowly escaped a massacre of some kind.
Right. I believe it's around this time where we get our big reveal, right?
Yes. You said they all run together. This is around that time.
Yes. So
the movie starts to become more flashback, more hallucination than not after a certain point.
Right. So the two of them are desperately trying to get out ahead of the death squads, and they're trying to get on this bus along with hundreds of other people, basically trying to get away from the guys with the guns. And this woman on the bus is saying, "We can't take any more, only kids," or whatever. I don't know when exactly it happened, but
it's chaos on the street. In the confusion, it's hard to say.
Somehow Rial has already gotten on board.
Mm-hmm.
And Ball is trying to get on, and he holds up his daughter and says, "She's a child." And I thought that he was going to put her on the bus and somehow catch up to her later, and they were going to show us how, I guess. But instead, he ends up on the bus, and so all three of them are on the bus. And then,
because you can feel a twist coming, and you think, okay, the gang's all here. What's the catch?
Their daughter, Nyagak, is wailing. And it's not just from, like, fear, you can tell. And we discover that she is not their daughter.
Yep. It was a Billy Zane switcheroo. Like a Titanic, "I have a child!" Not to make light of it, but that's exactly what's going on.
That's exactly
it. Another woman is chasing the bus.
And absolutely. I already used the word wailing, but again, it's the right word in both cases. Absolutely just wailing, crying out for her daughter, and the married couple is just trying to stay even keeled as much as they can and calm the girl down.
Right.
Then basically we get run through the escape process once again, and the girl's drowning.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had this information brought to us a couple different ways. First, Ball has basically a sit down with the witch, like lights a candle, puts it on the floor in the living room, and sits on the couch and waits for the witch to show up.
And you can just see a faint red face in the darkness just on the very edge of the firelight. It's quite spooky. And disconcertingly tall, too. Yes. It's like 7.5 feet off the ground.
And two hands hold out a knife and says, like, "Sever your flesh and I will take you and I will bring her back in your place."
Mm-hmm. One of the women in the classroom also offers a knife to the wife.
Yeah, and the wife has the option. It's not sever your own flesh, it's sever his flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Crucially, this is said in the same voice, so it's just the witch wearing different faces. When Ball first hears this, he like tests his hand over this fire that has, like, this bonfire that has emerged in place of the candle, realizes he's not being burned. And at first thinks that, oh, well, if I can just ride this out, I'll be fine.
Yeah,
hurt me.
He tries to call the witch's bluff. So, you know, pictures can't hurt me. It's right out of The Shining, you know, Danny Torrance going, "It's just like pictures in a book, Danny." Maybe it can hurt him. Maybe it can't. It can scare him witless, though.
Yes.
I mean, he will not withstand that storm forever. The witch ups the ante and puts him back out in the middle of the ocean, being tormented by the specter of his daughter, who is not, in fact, his daughter, with like a squid crawling out of her throat.
Yeah. So we're not sure at this point. We think maybe his wife is going to end up going after him, but instead she finds him in the kitchen, having already cut his arm open.
Yeah, she does it when her back is turned, and we're with her by the kitchen sink, and we just hear a snicket. You know, that noise that knives always make in movies when they move at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just the sound of them slicing the air.
Yeah.
And then she turns back, and he's opened a hole in his arm.
Yeah. So she steps out of the room at his bidding. Go, you have to get out. She never actually leaves the house, though. And behind her, so out of her line of sight, the witch shows up, emerges from a hole in the floor.
Yeah, kind of punches his way up through the tiles.
Yeah. Crawls out and is in full wrinkly corpse demon mode.
Mm-hmm.
And starts digging his hand into the wound, almost like...
he's just going to slither inside Ball's skin.
Well, it reminded me most of, like, Gary in The Thing, yes. Getting The Thing's hand in his face.
In his face, and under his face, and yeah.
Yes, it was pretty much exactly like that, except more visceral and less... this is not to say that The Thing is not visceral, because it very much is, but that, at least, there's a little more of an almost putty feeling
right.
to his face, whereas this is very much like, this is what it would feel like if there's a hand going under your skin.
Yeah, right. At least in The Thing, it's mercifully seamless. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is how The Thing does it. You know, you're just one composite entity.
Yeah.
So it's just a smooth transition from one body to the next, undifferentiated. Here, it's more invasive in a sense.
Yeah. But nevertheless, it does call to mind that. And he's just pushing his way further and further in. Rial has a hand take her hand, and the girl is there. But basically, she decides to give up on the deal and goes into the kitchen and takes the knife and just opens the witch's throat.
Yeah.
This is hardcore as hell.
Yeah, and it's great because you're always, you know, I imagine when you sit down to write a movie like this, you invent a monster, you have to ask yourself, okay, what's the silver bullet? And I kind of like when there just isn't one.
Yeah.
I mean, It Follows from several years ago ends with them just shooting it in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inconclusive. Like, maybe it's still out there, maybe it isn't.
Right.
But, and here they just slit its throat. And it's like, if you can just kill it through some normal means, but invest it with a kind of supernatural significance, then you can get away with just murdering it in a kind of mundane way. It's weirdly refreshing. I mean, you don't see a lot of that. You see a lot more of, I don't know, it can only be killed with sunlight, or it can only be killed with this or with that. You have to take its picture and then crumple up the Polaroid.
Thanks, Dauberman.
And then, you know, set the Polaroid on fire.
Not that Polaroid is a Dauberman thing.
It might as
that
well
would be. Well, that would be bad even for Gary Dauberman.
That's true.
I think. But that's sort of like very video gamey literalization of fighting a demon. That's very Dauberman.
Right. Got to aim for the big glowing weak spot.
Anyhow, I mean, that's basically the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. We have Matt Smith coming by with two new co-workers, higher-ups, we get the impression.
They've had time to fix the place up a little.
Yeah, I mean, they've painted part of the wall, and Ball has apparently, like, filled in the holes in the walls with some kind of plaster or something. And the two of them, Ball and Rial, seem much more composed. The other two bureaucrats, like, go in the other room, and Matt Smith is just like, so is there a witch here still? And Ball says, no, she killed it. And they talk about, you know, are there still ghosts here? And Ball has a little speech about, I say little just in that it's not, like, long and rambly, not that it's insignificant. He says, yes, but your ghosts, they follow you, they live with you, you just have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt Smith is just like, you guys are fucking nuts, but good luck.
Bloody mad, I believe is the expression he would have used.
Right, well, yeah, exactly.
So when the
mental,
when the, yeah, right, when the bureaucrats leave, you see what a packed house it has become.
Just chock full of ghosts.
Yeah, they're surrounded, and it's a claustrophobic feeling, but it also does seem like they've made peace with it. I mean, it's the spirits, not just of the girl they abducted, and not just even everyone who perished on the ocean, but...
seems like some of the women who perished in the schoolhouse.
Yeah.
And, you know,
all of their baggage basically is with them to stay, and they're trying to come to grips with that.
Yep. Cut to black, title drop, his house, and that's the movie. So we'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some more thoughts afterwards.
You having problems with the puppy?
This is what they want. They like to see us crazy. Let them send us back.
How quickly you forget everything we went through to get here. We are not going back.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
There's no witch.
Get up!
What is that?
Rats.
Rats did this.
You went outside.
This is my house!
This is my house!
This is my house! My house!
You don't wonder what it tells me. It says I should be afraid of you.
And we're back. So, Matt, talk about his house.
So, I really like... I mean, opening with the nightmare of the drowning is resonant. It resonates through the remainder of the movie. And it lets you know that this movie is going to be a gut punch. It's going to be heavy. It lets you know what you're in for. Although the movie has... There are layers to that punch to the gut that do not reveal themselves until relatively late in the game when you realize the con that they had to pull in order to get out on the water in the first place, and the fact that they jeopardized this girl who they had no legitimate claim to, who then died. So it's not just the survivor guilt of a parent. In some ways, I imagine it's less intense than that would be, but also more intense because there was no reason for her to be on that boat with them
right
when she met her end. So... it's good stuff. I mean, I really like the fine print that is administered at the beginning of the movie about how you can't do this, you can't do that. It reminded me, and I'm always likening everything to The Shining, it reminded me of the interview scene in The Shining, where you get the sense that Jack Nicholson is playing nice with this guy, and he's a little bit weirder than he's letting on. I mean, it's Jack Nicholson, he's always a little bit weirder than he's letting on, but he's just kind of playing ball because he needs this job. A lot of things are established, you know, about basically in The Shining, what's established is that they're going to get be snowed in and then they'll just be stuck there. And here there's also a sense of being stuck, but it's not inclement weather. It's just the machine of bureaucracy, you know, that if you step out of line to the left or the right half an inch, you'll be right back where you started.
Right.
So that sense of kind of having to always be on your best behavior is oppressive, and it really fills the whole movie with this feeling of kind of hopelessness. You've already been through so much pain, and now you've been thrust into this unlivable situation. I mean, not only is the house a total wash, but then it's full of ghosts to top it all off, and you just have to grin and bear it. There's a scene where he literally grins and bears it when he's been chased out of the house by an angry spirit, and then he sees a neighbor lady, white lady, looking at him, and he smiles, this big, friendly, like TV commercial smile, and it's a laugh-out-loud funny moment, but you also feel the pressure that's on him to act like everything's hunky-dory.
Well, yeah, and also among the many stipulations is that we're going to give you 74 pounds a week, and also you can't get jobs.
Right.
So you have to live on 74 pounds a week. Time was when pound sterling was like $2 or more to the pound, but these days it's really not that much more than a dollar. Granted, you can get food and things like that somewhat cheaper in the UK than you can the United States, just on a purchasing power parity basis. This is a long way of building up to the point of it's not a lot of fucking money to live on, even if you're not paying rent, which I got the impression that they weren't.
Well, and even when you can just hand wave away the fact, oh, the cleaners never came by, What, so then it's on them now also to make the place look presentable, or they'll be held accountable for living in squalor.
Yeah, and you know, that's
so where is that? Where is that? Where are those resources coming from? Where's the fucking plaster coming from that he uses to patch up the holes?
Out of the 74 pounds a week.
Granted, he put some of those holes there, but not all of them.
Yeah. Out of the $86 a week, or, you know, whatever. So yeah, that is the question that you're kind of forced to ask yourself. Jesus Christ. So, okay, they have to buy food, and they have to occasionally wash their clothes and all this. God forbid they have to buy anything else. How?
And they're used to... This is the same thing I brought up during the plot rundown. What I like about Rial's character, it is Rial, isn't it?
Yeah.
What I like about her character, which I alluded to, is that she's really not afraid of ghosts. She doesn't appear to be afraid of much of anything after what she's had to put up with. They're used to doing without. There aren't any maudlin scenes of the two of them tearfully going like, how are we going to make ends meet? They'll just do what they can with what they have. I mean, they're scrappy, but people in that position are bound to hit their breaking point sooner or later. I mean, he does when he's in Matt Smith's office and he crushes the glass in his fist without meaning to, without even realizing he's doing it.
Yeah.
And the way that like racism is depicted in the movie is also not after school special ever. It's so easy to fall into that trap. There's a scene where a bunch of neighborhood youths, black teenagers, waste Rial's time when she asks them for directions. They kind of give her the runaround. Oh, it's this way. No, it's that way. And then eventually reveal that they're just fucking with her. You know, go back to Africa.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack is like just ratcheting up, and the whole time the camera's spinning around. There was a scene I didn't much care for in Bad Hair. It's when she thinks that she's about to get sacked, or you know, the camera does the blowout thing.
Right.
Does like several 360 revolutions around the office when she's having that meeting with her new boss. That I thought was a little too ostentatious for what was going on. Here, almost the exact same thing happens. I mean, the camera doesn't whirl around quite that balletically, I guess, but it is really filmmaking that's swinging for the bleachers, even though there doesn't appear to be anything seriously awry. I mean, you can tell that they're wasting her time and harassing her, but it's not like she gets mugged. It's not like she's physically assaulted, but it's just the strain of being a fish out of water and knowing that these people are, it's the dread of like, this is going bad, but like, how bad is this gonna go? It's that kind of thing. Is one of them going to take a swing at her? What the fuck is going to happen? And even though she makes it away without a scratch on her, you feel the relief, basically, when that happens because of what the camera was doing and what the music was doing. You really share her distress. If anything, I felt more distressed than she did, or at least than she let on.
Right.
She might have just been maintaining a poker face.
Right. There's another scene, speaking of sort of the movies, more subtle, not after school specially treatment of racism, when Baal is going into some kind of clothing store. He walks in and he's looking a little disheveled, as he gradually does more and more throughout the movie, just because of what they're going through in that house. But he looks a little disheveled and he walks by, and the second the like store security guard, house detective, spots him, his eyes are just rooted on him the whole time, and there is never a shot of just that guy. There is never a close-up of that guy. He's always just in the background, even a little bit out of focus, but we can always see him lurking behind, constantly following Baal with his eyes.
Right.
And that was also really on point.
We talked about the scraping silverware and the crushing glass in his fist. There's a lot of excellent sound design in this movie that really kind of makes your skin crawl. You know that Rial is having some kind of vision of Sudan even before she lays eyes on the women in the classroom, because you can hear the trilling from around the corner, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, there's just so much on the soundtrack that signifies distress, or in that moment when she's surrounded by the trilling women, you really feel her letting her guard down for the first time in who knows how long, you know, that she's back home. She feels more at ease with these people than she's felt at any point in her new home. And there's a whole bunch of that. I like the glass under the desk particularly. It reminded me of The Grifters. At the end of The Grifters, a character meets a nasty end. Very unexpected, and the weapon of choice is just a glass of whiskey, water, I don't even remember. The glass in question is out of frame almost the whole scene, but the whole scene, you can hear the ice cubes clinking every time the character moves, and so you never forget that the glass is there, but because you're not looking at it, you're not expecting, and it's not an obvious murder weapon either.
Right.
And all of a sudden, anyway, I shan't spoil it. Point being, you hear that like before you know where it's coming from. I thought maybe he was grinding his teeth. I thought, is that supposed to be music? Is that literally happening? Or is that just the sound of his sanity shattering? You know, it sounds like ice breaking almost. I don't know what I'm hearing, but I don't like it. And then you realize where it's coming from. And it's just excellent, excellent Foley work.
Yeah. The state of the house, and this is a movie we already did an episode on, and we've already invoked once in Relic. Another episode. Yeah,
not
Relic.
Not to be confused with The Relic.
Relic, which, for anyone who didn't listen to that episode, or whatever episode we referenced it in afterwards, it features this house, which is...
You should have left, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right. This house that is sort of rotten to the core, and some places it's more visible than others, but there's this moldy, blackened sort of decrepitude going mm-hmm. on, and you very much get that vibe before Ball rips off the wallpaper. He has this nightmare sequence where a sheet of it just rolls right off the wall, and it's just straight up all black.
Yeah.
Including this big hole that some arms reach out of. And that was very Relic.
Yeah, the peeling wallpaper reminded me of Barton Fink more than
sure,
anything. The,
sure.
The heat making the wallpaper come unglued, all the
breach my Leffy at your peril.
Yeah. Well, that in that movie, the it's steadily escalating anxieties to do with having the devil for a housemate. You know, it's like being next door to hell. You know, that's why
right.
it keeps getting hotter and hotter. Here, it's not the devil turning up the temperature. It's just, it's like the nightmare where he's eating dinner in a piece, like a torn off scrap of apartment out on the high seas. You know, it's just that feeling of everything falling to pieces on you. Some malaise that can't be cured.
Yeah. The ghost encounters are all more or less universally well done.
A lot of it is just, you hear rapid footfalls, like a... of just someone quickly padding, like, out of sight. It reminded me of... I feel like there's a moment in, maybe more than one moment in Hereditary, where Toni Collette is, like, barefootedly, just kind of, like, tip-tapping very quickly across a wood floor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a distressing sound.
Yeah.
Because it's not like a lumbering noise. It's something fast and lightweight. And that, to me, for whatever reason, when we're talking about ghosts, that's scarier to me than a big booming
like
step
a big thud
that rattles the whole house.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that it's light on its feet is more alarming to me. I don't
yeah,
know why.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, something that has to thud around, maybe you think maybe you can outrun it or something.
Yeah.
Something that's skittering around, it's a lot more difficult to avoid. But
well, then it's also like, is it a child? Am I being haunted by a child's ghost, which is just automatically scarier?
Yeah, spooky dead kid. Mm-hmm. Fuck that. And they are, among other ghosts.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, this is the first movie we've watched for the podcast in at least 6 or 7 episodes that really got under my skin and scared me in a visceral sense. I mean, there have been episodes we've done lately where I've liked the movie just in general, but it hasn't necessarily really gotten under my skin, but this one definitely did.
Yeah, and kudos for that, because you are not alone in that respect.
Yeah. During those scenes, it was all really effective stuff. It's just very well composed visually. The lighting was impeccable. Obviously, it's dark, but there's just enough light to make out certain things. The use of shadow was impeccable.
Mm-hmm. There were only 2 ghost encounters that sort of didn't do it for me. One is just like a less than a full second of footage, and it's just when he's having a nightmare, which otherwise worked just fine. It might even be the one that starts with him eating dinner. He's out on the water and corpses start coming out of the froth and spume to kind of claw at him, and this is precipitated by him looking down at one floating corpse, and its eye just like turns to look at him. The head doesn't turn, just the eye kind of darts in his direction, the pupil. And it's a CGI element, and it just looked a little too Pirates of the Caribbean.
I was just
going
to say
it's extremely Pirates of the Caribbean, and it is less than a second, but that was the first time that the movie was not completely sure-footed. It's the kind of thing I wouldn't even comment on in a lesser film.
Right.
And the other ghostly encounter that sort of rubbed me the wrong way, unfortunately, is the climactic one, and it's only because, and I grew to like it, but the reveal of the witch, the Night Witch, the Apeth, as I think they call it, is a little I Am Legend. It looks a little like, it looks kind of like the Polaroid monster.
Well,
actually,
it's funny you mention that, because I was looking into it, and the figure, not the voice, I believe, but the figure of the Apeth was played by Javier Botet, who did the demon in Polaroid,
okay,
and fucking Keyface from Insidious, Key the Last
Face.
Key.
Talk about a fucking D-lister, Keyface.
Right, I'm forgetting at least probably 8 to 10. This guy, in the last 4 or 5 years, I think, has become a go-to for tall, gangly demons.
Yeah, if Doug Jones,
you know,
is busy,
doing the
mocap. Give this guy a ring, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure he's played monsters that I found more formidable than Keyface. You know,
right, that's just the one that comes to mind.
And he, you know, has, I'm sure, acquitted himself admirably in all of those movies. I warmed up to the Night Witch here once, because you get a good look at him. It's like a relatively brightly lit scene by this movie's standards. Part of it was just the sheer sadistic glee that the creature evinces when it's fucking around with his arm wound.
Yeah.
You see the look on its face, it's just raw sadism. I mean, he's just so delighted to be inflicting harm on this man, and it's just like that naked glee made me warm up to the otherwise kind of uninspired creature design. I don't know if that was the gentleman whose name you just rattled off, if that was like mocap work on his part or if it was totally invented in post, but it was a good performance, whether by an animator or by an actor.
Right. Yeah, I agree. When he comes out of the hole in the floor / sand pit and you first see him, it's like, okay, this looks a little too much like the Polaroid monster for my liking in a movie that is far and away leaps and bounds better than Polaroid. I was hoping for more, but yeah, as you say, once he gets to work, yeah, that sort of gleeful, sadistic grin is really chilling.
And like I said, I like that he's dispatched just with a regular carving knife.
Regular-ass knife, not mm-hmm. a magic knife.
She doesn't even have to say a prayer over it or anything. There's no fucking rosaries involved. It's just her commitment, I think, to refuting it, you know, refuting the monster into breaking the deal. I think that there is like a magical element at play, but it's strictly, it's very organic. I mean, it just emerges from her willing the thing to die. And they don't even talk about it in those terms. This might just be leftover, oh, you can only beat Pennywise if you really believe, or you can only beat Freddy Krueger if you really believe, you know, that kind of thing. But that was my impression of why that played out the way it did.
I don't think that's an unreasonable conclusion to draw from that. I think, yeah, I agree. It's, I think her intention, there was power behind her intention.
Right.
And as you say, that's where the magic comes from, as opposed to you have to say this incantation, you have to do this ritual or have this fucking artifact in order to carry out what you're trying to do.
Well, that's what makes him burning the heirloom so funny, is because in a Gary Dauberman movie, that would have worked. The movie would have been over.
Well, no.
No, he burned the cursed necklace.
Well, right.
Or the necklace just would not have burned. It would
right.
have been fireproof.
Or it, like, very explicitly, there would have been, like, a long lore-based explanation for like why that backfired,
or made it worse. Yeah, exactly.
Whereas this is just like nothing happens.
Yeah, here
it is completely immaterial.
It's not about finding the Horcrux. It's just to do with belief, and I like that a lot. I wish that I saw more of it. It's possible. The other reading, too, is that his heart was kind of in the right place when he was burning the heirlooms, because he was trying to sever their connection with Sudan and, you know, send the witch back where it came from, in a sense. And I think that when the wife slits the thing's throat,
she's getting on board.
Yeah, she's saying, no, this is our home now. We are actually going to start fresh, clean slate. And so she is, in a sense, shedding a kind of psychological heirloom, which then renders the monster powerless. Or susceptible to knives.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can get on to our recommendations now. I think what I'd like to recommend is a classic, a stone cold classic of a horror movie. And I don't mean one that's like 40 some odd years old or anything like that, but I think it's still absolutely under any metric qualifies as a classic, and that's A Tale of Two Sisters.
Mm.
It's possibly, I don't know if it's my favorite horror movie, but I think it's the one that scared me the most.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly among my favorites in general. It's a Korean film directed by Kim Ji-woon, and it follows these two sisters who go live in this house in the country with their father and their stepmother, and they have to deal with these fucking ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about that movie, I've honed this explanation down to a science, but I've never trotted it out for the podcast, so I feel like I'm on safe ground here.
Thrill me.
Well, you've heard it before.
Oh, well.
Probably. But the thing that I love about A Tale of Two Sisters is that it knows how to scare you with a creepy ghost. And what I mean by that is, in a typical American jump scare built horror movie, it's very much like, okay, here's the ghost. It's going to pop at you. Boo. And then it's over. Or you'll just keep getting the ghost thrown at you until you become accustomed to it, and then it's worthless. But what A Tale of Two Sisters does is it will put the ghost in the corner of a dark room with you, and it'll just be there, and you just have to look at it. And the movie just forces you to keep looking at it.
Yeah.
As it draws closer and closer.
Kim Ji-woon is just, you know, you'll blink before I do. Make my
strap
fucking
in, get fucked. Uh-huh. Like, and I think there's a little bit of that DNA in his house in a lot of the ghost encounters, like the girl Nyagak haunting them, and Ball in particular. She'll crop up and she'll be like juddering around in the background, sort of limping around and being ominous, and then she'll walk around in front of him, like right next to him, and then she'll be standing in the opposite corner of the room, daring him to move. He'll turn the lights on, but then he'll, for some reason, feel compelled to turn them back off, and she'll be there again,
mm-hmm.
but closer. And yeah, as I said, A Tale of Two Sisters scared the shit out of me, still does. And I think the reason why this movie got under my skin the way it did is because it shares some of that same DNA.
Yeah, I mean, I said that first ghost sighting is reminiscent of J-horror, K-horror, when you see the little girl crouching on the floor just behind her father, who is not, in fact, her father.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that feeling of, you know, there could be, as I'm sitting here speaking into this microphone, there could be a ghost behind me. It's that feeling that you're never, you can never really relax.
There's not. How am I? Am I clear?
Yeah, you're so far so good.
Okay, cool. We'll keep an eye out for each other.
That's the least we can do. let me see. I'm going to recommend a movie from just last year, I think, called Atlantics.
I thought you might.
Yeah. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Okay.
But from what I know of Atlantics, I thought it might come up.
It's not a horror movie. It is a ghost story, however, and it is about the refugee experience. It's about people who perished at sea under the exact same circumstances that this movie opens under, and their restless spirits coming back to haunt a tycoon in their country of origin. And there's a monologue. It's a kind of languorous movie. It's not scary basically ever. It's not really aiming to be. It's more of a melancholy ghost story. But one of the spirits gets a monologue towards the end where he, with a very flat affect, just describes the moments leading up to their capsizing. That's absolutely chilling. I mean, it reminded me of the kind of feeling you get from like sailor stories, like Davy Jones shit, you know, mm-hmm. but like actually properly frightening. Like there's something about ghosts at sea that is a different kind of blood curdling. And I don't know why. He describes the image that will be with me till I die. And you don't even see it. I think if I remember correctly, his whole speech plays out over images of placid water. which somehow makes it even more disturbing, mm-hmm. because, you know, like, oh, well, the sea looks so calm now, but then it's a, you know, kind of a, that is like a tragic counterpoint to what he's describing. He says, we sighted land and everyone was overjoyed, and then we realized it wasn't a landmass, it was a wave. Like you know, and they were, and yeah, fuck, and they were just done for. And that line, that speech, but that really that line in particular makes that entire movie for me. And I could not get that movie out of my head watching His House for self-evident reasons, I would think. Again, don't watch it expecting to be scared. It's, I guess, sort of emotionally grueling, but I tend to favor kind of art house, fart house stuff in this segment. Not universally, but much of the time. And this is definitely another instance of that, although I think it's well worth your time. This is more tangential, I suppose, but if you wanted to see a movie that is actually properly scary, that sort of reminded me of His House, just in the sense that it's a haunted house story with a sociological subtext. Under the Shadow, Babak sure. Anvari is quite good, quite scary. And it's another movie where the nature of the haunting is invested with this sort of wartime anxiety that really does wonders for the movie's tension level. So that's it for me, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, I haven't seen Atlantics, but I've been meaning to for a long time, and I'm sure I will eventually. Under the Shadow is great. I'm completely on board with that. And yeah, Tale of Two Sisters.
Yeah, I'm going to a ringing endorsement of that one, too. That movie is it's a scary flick.
But His House is also very good, as I think we've hopefully successfully conveyed over the course of this episode.
You can't go wrong with any of them.
So with that being said, I think we'll wrap up here. So I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from His House official trailer, Netflix, uploaded by Netflix. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, December 6th, and we'll be discussing the perennially delayed, finally released X-Men property, The New Mutants. See you then.